Kelly, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize, Executive Director of the Community and Power and Development Association. Thank you so much. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Livvy Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Our General Manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Gran. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask, and go to our website at democracynow.org for our coverage of the Gulf Coast, for our coverage of the conventions, for our coverage of global issues and the issue of police brutality and the climate crisis.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
Good morning. The Gap will not be on this morning, but join us at 6 p.m. tonight to discuss the recent national conventions with various KBOO programmers. Again, that's 6 p.m. today on KBOO, your local community connection.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Kyle Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old white militia member and Trump supporter, has been charged in the killing of two protesters and injuring one other in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Protesters had gathered in response to the police shooting of Jacob Blake in front of his three children. Mr. Blake is now paralyzed. Meanwhile, players in the NBA, the WNBA, Major League Baseball, and Major League Soccer have gone on strike in protest of the police shooting of Jacob Blake, following a slew of other police shootings and killings of Black people, including George Floyd, Rayshard Brooks, and Breonna Taylor. Let's see if we have a clip on those right now. Let's go to that clip.
The past 4 months have shed a light on the ongoing racial injustice facing our African-American community. Citizens around the country have used their voices and platforms to speak out against these wrongdoings. Over the last few days in our home state of Wisconsin, we've seen the horrendous video of Jacob Blake being shot in the back 7 times by a police officer in Kenosha, and the additional shooting of protesters. Despite the overwhelming plea for change, there has been no action. So our focus today cannot be on basketball.
When we take the court and represent Milwaukee and Wisconsin, we are expected to play at a high level, give maximum effort, and hold each other accountable. We hold ourselves to that standard, and in this moment, we are demanding the same from lawmakers and law enforcement. We are calling for justice for Jacob Blake and demand the officers be held accountable. For this to occur, it is imperative for the Wisconsin State Legislature to reconvene after months of inaction and take up meaningful measures to address issues of police accountability, brutality, and criminal justice reform. We encourage all citizens to educate themselves, take peaceful and responsible action, and remember to vote on November 3rd on behalf of the Milwaukee Bucks.
I think firearms are a huge issue in America. I don't know how you clean that up. I'm not saying that I got all the answers, but guns are, they are a huge issue in America. And not just, they're not used for just hunting. You know, that a lot of people do for sport. You know, we, right now, for black people right now, we are hunting, we think it's you hunting us. If you're sitting here telling me that there was no way to subdue that gentleman, or detain him, or to just, before the firing of guns, then you're sitting here, you're lying to not only me, you're lying to every African American, every black person in the community. Because we see it over and over and over. There was multiple, if you watch the video, there was multiple moments where if they wanted to, they could have tackled him, they could have grabbed him. You know, they could have done that. And why does it always have to get to a point where we see the guns fire? And his family is there, the kids are there, it's in broad daylight.
All right, and those, you heard the voices of George Hill and Sterling Brown from the Milwaukee Bucks, and the last voice you heard, LeBron James. Our guest is the Reverend Dr. Monica L. Cummings, Assistant Minister at Bradford Community Church Unitarian Universalist, which is based in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Also, we get an update on Hurricane Laura that slammed into Texas and Louisiana as a Category 4 with Gulf resident and environmentalist Monique Harden. On August 29, 50 years ago, over 30,000 Chicano activists marched in East L.A. What was it about, and what were the circumstances that caused the death at that event of L.A. Times journalist Ruben Salazar? Our guests are Lupe Carrasco Cardon and Jorge Rodriguez, both co-chairs of the 50th anniversary Chicano Moratorium Organizing Committee. By our weekly Earth Watch, Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, weighs in on the Biden-Harris environmental proposals. Also, our weekly Earth Minute. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. First, we are going to very quickly go to what is happening in, or has been happening in, Kenosha, Wisconsin. And I'd like to first go to a clip from The Guardian. Many of you recall, of course, that yet another black man was shot by the police. He was unarmed, although the police are now claiming that there was a knife on the floor of his vehicle. His three children, by the way, were in the car at the time that the police shot Mr. Blake, who is now paralyzed. And meanwhile, Kyle Rittenhouse, 17-year-old white militia member and Trump supporter, has been charged in the killing of two protesters and the injuring of one other in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Let us go now to hear from the sister of Jacob Blake.
And when you say the name Jacob Blake, make sure you say father, make sure you say cousin, mm-hmm. Make sure you say son, make sure you say uncle, but most importantly, make sure you say human. Human life. Let it marinate in your mouth, in your minds. A human life. Just like every single one of y'all and everywhere around the world, we're human. And his life matters. So many people have reached out to me telling me they're sorry that this happened to my family. Well, don't be sorry, because this has been happening to my family for a long time, longer than I can account for. It happened to Emmett Till. Mm. Emmett Till is my family. Mm. Philando, Mike Brown, Sandra. This has been happening to my family. And I've shed tears for every single one of these people that it's happened to. This is nothing new. I'm not sad. I'm not sorry. I'm angry. Mm. And I'm tired. Mm. I haven't cried one time. I stopped crying years ago. Mm. I am numb. Mm. I have been watching police murder people that look like me for years. Mm. I'm also a Black history minor. Mm. So not only have I been watching it in the 30 years that I've been on this planet, but I've been watching it for years before we were even alive. I'm not sad. I don't want your pity. I want change.
All righty. And I'd now like to welcome our guest, Reverend Dr. Monica L. Cummings, Assistant Minister at Bradford Community Church, Unitarian Universalist, based in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Reverend Dr. Cummings, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Margaret, and good morning to you and your listeners.
Yes, you know, there's been so much talk and attacks happening against the protesters now at the RNC. And it seems as though there is so much focus on the fact that there was somewhat a rebellion that caused some burnings of buildings, some damage of property, and the focus is moved away from the fact of what caused people to react in that way. But I'd like your thoughts on the situation.
You know, and you're absolutely right that the looting, the larceny has distracted away from what we've been calling for years, and that's justice and police reform. And Jacob's sister, what powerful words. Gosh, it's you know, and I can feel her pain. She didn't say pain, but you know, I can feel her pain. And it is so multi-layered. You know, you have people in the African-American community traumatized one more time, and people who are traumatized, you know, it's just layered and layered and layered. And then on the other hand, we have people who are living in absolute fear. Kenosha's on lockdown. Businesses are boarded up. And so when you have people who are traumatized and people who are responding and reacting out of fear, that's typically not a good recipe for people being able to communicate and talk with one another. And I've been going into Civic Park where a lot of actions have happened, taken place. And I talked with the militia. I talked with the guy who appointed himself as leader who called militia to come to Kenosha. And I asked him, you know, and I asked all of them, why would you show up to a peaceful protest with automatic weapons and assault rifles? Like, why would you show up here? And the response was they're there to protect property and lives. And I said, it doesn't make sense for you to be here because we're here peacefully. So to have the police chief, you know, pretty much blame the two people who were killed for breaking the curfew. Well, what about the guy who shot them? He was breaking the curfew as well. So either the curfew is uniform and everyone has to abide by it, or it's not. You know, is the curfew just for the protesters? Or, you know, so these are questions that I have for the leadership, and including the mayor. I am a member of CUSH, which is Congregations United to Save Humanity's Religious Leaders Caucus, and we met with the mayor of Kenosha last month in July, and we offered our services to support him and helping to look at policing here in Kenosha, to look at how justice is passed here in Kenosha. And his response to us was that the police and community relations are good.
Well, let me ask you this. Reverend Dr. Cummings, we have very little time here. Okay. What about this contrast of property versus human life?
Yeah, and that's been an argument. The lead minister at Bradford, in a statement he put out, said he'd rather lose 100 buildings than one more life. And I don't think it has to be either or. I think people get caught up in that conversation, property versus life. It doesn't have to be either or. It has to be people being willing to sit down at the table and talk about the injustice that continues to happen and what happens with people who are disenfranchised. You know, the violence in the uprising is the language of the oppressed. When people
right, that is quoting heard, you're quoting Dr. King, Reverend Dr. King there.
I am, and I don't condone that behavior, and I understand that behavior because it's been happening since the 60s. And what happened in Tulsa, you know,
right,
where Black
Dr. Cummings, I'm afraid we're really short of time. We are packed with our show today, but we do appreciate you joining us. And as I said in the intro, it's, you know, we see the response from the sports world, unprecedented. I myself am of African descent, and certainly you understand the grief and the anger. And we always have to keep focused on the cause of why people are grieved and anchored. So thank you so much for joining us. I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you.
Okay.
Reverend Dr. Monica Cummings. Margaret. Yes, thank you. We want to thank the Reverend Beth Johnson, who is one of the co-chairs in California of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, for her help with putting us in touch with Reverend Cummings. Now we're going to get a very, very brief update on the situation with Hurricane Laura. A lot of news, a lot happening today, and I'd like to welcome back to our show a Gulf resident and environmentalist, Monique Hardin. Monique, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and I'm just glad to say that I appreciate you through these years keeping an eye and helping us to have a voice what's happening in the Gulf region, especially as it relates to these disasters we're getting a lot of with the climate crisis.
Right. So what is your situation there? Are you safe, and what are you hearing from people as this storm, very, very dangerous, now hit as a Category 4, but it's now a Category 2, but can still cause quite a lot of damage?
Yeah, the Hurricane Laura is one for the record, and we're as the sun is coming up, we will begin to see just how damaging the hurricane is. What we I'm in New Orleans. We're pretty okay in New Orleans, although there are some forecasts about possible weather impacts from the storm that might be headed our way, but we certainly no way did. Were we in the path or the eye of this storm? It fell on the southwest side of the state, beginning at Cameron Parish, which touches the Gulf of Mexico, then on to the next parish of Calcasieu, and is headed up to Shreveport, and then, you know, everyone has seen the national trajectory into Arkansas and out to the mid-Atlantic area, Washington, D.C., by Saturday. This path was always a concern for us at the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice, Margaret, because it's a path through our environmental justice communities, where some of the largest companies that you know produce oil, refine oil, manufacture chemicals, operate just outside the doors and windows of homes where Black and Brown residents live. And these companies pay nothing in taxes. So with Laura, the damage that we are now beginning to see has happened in these communities, they don't have the the resources or contributions from these companies to aid in their recovery because, like I said, these companies do not pay taxes. So one of the end results of this is you know, how can we head off that predict what would otherwise be a predictable situation, where Black communities, Latino communities, become sicker and poor as a result of a disaster. That's really our challenge right now. How do we make this happen? There are 1.5 million people from the Gulf region that were evacuated. These are all what's known in the international human rights view as internally displaced persons who require immediate assistance for disaster recovery. Another concern is that with the search and rescue operations that are beginning with daybreak here in the Gulf region, emergency shelters, hotels, that whole search and rescue operation, they're all extremely necessary for survival, but they each, inherent in them are those COVID-19 risks of community spread and infection. And so this is, you know, we also now, you know, recognize that we can have multiple storms at virtually the same time. And so where does this look in terms of the future? There's a lot of work happening, I can tell you, in Louisiana and Texas, primarily at this point, around this idea of planned retreat that would result in figuring out the mechanisms and a process in which communities can plan to basically shut down and relocate elsewhere, and how to do that, how to fund that, how to make sure all needs are met and voices are heard in terms of making this something that's a free, voluntary choice of people and not something that's forced on. So these are all of the, you know, waves of issues and concerns we have that really affect policy decisions, affect funding, affect, you know, from tax policy, who we vote in office. These are, you know, ultimately come down to real civic participation in trying to get this right. And how do we do this in a way that makes communities whose needs have yet to be met because of racial inequity and injustice to be front of the line in terms of having treatment that is at the level of human dignity and human and respect for human rights.
Right, right. We literally are out of time, Monique, but there was a lot of concern about the storm surge and water coming in from the Gulf of Mexico, and perhaps even as the storm moves further, that more flooding will take place. Have you heard of any news of a storm surge or anything like that happening?
Right now, it's something that's under watch for most of Louisiana.
Okay.
So it's under watch. So the warnings are out. The concern is recognized, and it's something that right now that's being monitored.
Right. Well, the storm is still there with us. Monique Harden, please continue to keep us posted on this really very dangerous and alarming situation. Thank you for taking the time to join us, and please, you and all of your loved ones, continue to stay safe.
Thank you, Margaret.
We are going to take a quick station break now, and coming up, Tom Goldtooth with the Indigenous Environmental Network joining us, and also the 50th anniversary of the Chicano Moratorium. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
We are indigenous people. Yes, we are indigenous people.
And that song, Indigenous People by Arise Roots. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio. We're also worldwide and nationwide on SoundCloud. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Washington, D.C. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Russian Federation. Yes, we do have a following there. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to go to our weekly Earth Minute.
On Monday, the Trump administration approved drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, opening up millions of acres of wilderness to drilling for the first time. After completing its review of an oil and gas leasing program, Secretary of the Interior David Bernhardt has stated that he expects the first round of leasing to take place before the end of 2020. The Trump era is characterized by major deregulation of climate and environmental policies, while expanding oil and gas drilling. According to an analysis by the Center for American Progress, the lease sales would result in the release of more than 4.3 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide, roughly three-quarters of the U.S. annual emissions. This drilling plan has long been contested by indigenous communities in northern Alaska, who not only consider the region sacred, but also depend upon the local ecosystem for their subsistence living. Indigenous lands are increasingly destroyed for oil development. We must stand with the indigenous peoples of the Arctic and fight alongside to protect the sacred lands. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Teresa Church for Global Justice Ecology Project.
Right, and from there, we're going to go now to our weekly Earth Watch, and let's start out hearing from Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee for President of the United States, and what he has to say, part of what he has to say on a clean energy revolution.
I'm announcing my plan for a clean energy revolution. It outlines what we have to do to meet this challenge head on and how we're going to get there. We're going to invest $1.7 trillion in securing our future so that by 2050, the United States will be 100% clean energy economy with net zero emissions. By the end of my first term, we will have an enforcement mechanism in place to make sure we stay on track to get there. Now we're going to make record-breaking investments in research and development in zero carbon technologies so that America is the engine of the world's clean energy economy. Exporting cutting-edge equipment stamped Made in the USA to help other nations reduce emissions and mitigate and adapt. This initiative will create more than 10 million new good-paying jobs all across the clean economy in the United States of America. It's an enormous opportunity. We'll hold polluters accountable for the damage they've caused, particularly in low-income communities and communities of color. Not only due to climate change, but the pollution they are pumping into the air that is breathed and the water that is drunk in those communities. You know, we're not going to forget the workers either. The workers who, through dangerous and back-breaking labor, powered our industrial rise, mined and built our arsenal democracy, and fueled America's prosperity through the 20th century. They've earned our thanks, our respect, and our support. Finally, we have to bring the world along with us. Global action requires American leadership. But the United States only accounts for 15% of global carbon emissions. The rest of the world has to step up as well. So on day one, I will immediately rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. But that's not sufficient. We need to dramatically accelerate our worldwide effort to meet the intensity of the challenge we face. So I'll immediately get to work, leading a diplomatic initiative to get every nation to go beyond their initial commitment, to push our progress further and faster.
All righty. So on Tuesday, August 25th, Senate Democrats unveiled a 260-page plan to tackle climate change resulting from ecological devastation. Their plan calls for the U.S. government to spend more than $400 billion a year to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. It has the stated goal of creating at least 10 million jobs in areas like research, clean energy manufacturing, and development of new technologies. And here to give some reaction to what is being proposed, I'd like to welcome, and it really is an honor actually, to welcome Tom Goldtooth, the Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Mr. Goldtooth has been awarded with recognition of his achievements throughout the past 40 years as an activist for social change and Indigenous-based just transition within the Indigenous and environmental and climate justice movements. Tom Goldtooth is a recipient of numerous awards, including the 2015 Gandhi Award and the 2016 award presented Sierra's Club highest recognition, the John Muir Award. Tom Goldtooth is also a Sundance leader and a great grandfather. Tom Goldtooth, welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
And Tom, your communities, the work you do so much based at frontline communities, because we have been covering on our show just the level of attacks, not only environmental, but poverty and otherwise in indigenous lands, a lot of extraction going on. Give us your response to what the Biden-Harris ticket, the Democrats are putting forward on their climate plan.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, you know, my prayers and our organization prayers to the brothers and sisters in the Gulf Coast and those folks in the bayou where that surge went through, but also, you know, Lake Charles. But right 40 miles northeast of Lake Charles is the Cushati tribal people. So, you know, our prayers go out to everyone there. Definitely that's related to a changing climate. And then also, in some of the earlier comments that I heard was, the opening up of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the sacred calving grounds of the porcupine caribou. We're working with the, Arctic Village and the Vinatai traditional consoles, as well as one of the organizations that's been doing this work for a long time, the Kuch'in Steering Committee. So a call out to them as well. Back to, this Democrat Special Committee on the Climate Crisis. They released their climate report, and it's not that much different than Biden's climate plan as well. This report was released 2 days ago, and we just needed to jump on that. It's what we call full of false solutions. In the report, the committee targets our tribal nations for carbon pricing projects, and then the report also omits recommendations to end fossil fuel subsidies and fails to target fossil fuel production overall as the primary contributor to climate change. That was very concerning to us. We've been pushing for this government and our Democrat leadership, to cut back on the subsidies and tax incentives. Roughly, conservative estimates is that amounts to around $20 billion per year. And 20% of it, goes to coal, even though there's an initiative to cut back of coal, but it's still there, and 80% to natural gas and crude oil. And that's a major funding mechanism, for just transition away from a fossil fuel economy. That's what we've been really advocating for as IEN. Not many people know about the whole world of carbon pricing and cap and trade programs like California's climate initiative a couple years ago, AB 32, that has four provisions of carbon offsets. When I talk about this, a lot of people in this country still don't know about it. I've been working 21 years on climate policy, and we've shown that carbon pricing mechanisms are false solutions that allow big polluters to keep polluting with little oversight. Cap and trade, carbon trading, it does not cut emissions at source. And the people in Richmond know that with the Chevron refinery. They're not cutting back their emissions. You ask them, what are you doing to address climate? They say, well, we're going carbon neutral. We're buying carbon credits in the forests in the Amazon. But that doesn't mean that they're going to cut emissions right there in the neighborhood of people of color and other poor folks. So this is why we're calling out, this report. And it's very important, as you said, with this history of fossil fuel expansion in Indian country, the pipeline issues, the tanker issues, tar sands, and, Alaska now. So, we live on the front lines of fossil fuel destruction and climate chaos. So targeting our native communities with carbon pricing is a false solution to climate change. It doesn't mitigate the problems our communities are facing. It just increases the wealth of the polluters. It's a greenwash. So that's why, you know, I did say this is horrific. This is unforgivable for this climate report to focus on this false solution in Indian country. And that's why we're calling that, you know, we have a plan. You know, it's centered around indigenous principles of just transition. These are available on our website. We got to keep fossil fuels in the ground. That includes cutting off these subsidies, tax breaks, and putting a national moratorium on fracking. So that's why, you know, we wanted to speak out on this, and also the committee has such faith in the unproven technologies like carbon capture, utilization, and storage, carbon sequestration in farming. They're even approaching our small farmers and saying, hey, we'll give you money if you know, for keeping the carbon in the soil. But they don't tell them where that money comes from. That money comes from the polluters to look good on paper that they've offset their pollution that they're producing. And also, you know, we need to really be concerned about the biofuel production. That's written in the plan. And linking natural gas with renewable energies in a so-called smart grid. So those are the concerns we do have. You know, some of the rebranding of some of these terminologies that allow the release of carbon emissions, such as decarbonization. This report has 106 mentions of the term decarbonization in the report. IEN, we've done a lot of study on this. We've gone to international arena meetings too. Decarbonization is the buzzword, but it does not mean cutting climate emissions at source. It's a manipulated term that allows the usage of the term net zero emissions. That just is a mechanism to allow business as usual, carbon pricing, carbon offsets, nuclear power, biofuels. You know, so that's why we're calling out the Democrat leadership that they have to reconsider these. You know, for us as indigenous peoples, you know, we're on that front line. The public lands where fossil fuel production is being explored and further developed, those are next door to our tribal lands. And those federal lands like Bears Ears, you know, those are sacred sites as well. This government does not recognize, you know, the spiritual and cultural values of what we've been saying is that, you know, don't put those pipelines across our lands. Don't continue to do fossil fuel development in desecrating our sacred lands. They just don't understand. So that's why we need the people. We need the people to continue to support our not only our water protectors out there, but also sky protectors. This is climate change, is that we need sky protectors as well.
Right, and I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there, Tom Goldtooth, but we do follow your work very closely. For people who want more information, the Indigenous Environmental Network website, we actually link with your website on ours, Sojourner Truth, and we so appreciate all of the work that you and others have been doing over the years, and all of the leadership, really, to all of us and the environmental movement and movements for change. So, Tom Goldtooth, I'm sure people will be going to your website to find out more information and what they could do, and we hope that you remain well and safe, and thank you so very much for joining us and breaking this down for us, Tom Goldtooth.
Yeah, thank you again, Margaret.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, on August 29, 1970, at the height of the Chicano movement and the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, over 30,000 Chicano activists came together in East L.A. to take part in the Chicano moratorium. Let's go to a clip from Fusion Now on the moratorium and what happened.
30,000 Chicanos marched through the streets of East LA that day. It was meant to be a peaceful anti-war demonstration. But within a couple of hours, it looked like a war zone. 200 people were arrested, 60 were wounded, and 4 killed. Wait, hold on a second. Let's rewind for a moment. It was 1970, it was the Vietnam War, and President Nixon had just intensified the war. Even after he said he would end it, thousands of American soldiers were returning home in caskets, and one community started to notice a pattern. Mexican Americans, who were just 10% of the population in southwestern states, were 20% of those killed in combat. This sparked a movement in defense of Latinx lives. It wasn't exactly a Black Lives Matter moment. No two movements in history are the same. But it was the beginning of a Latinx-led push for civil rights and part of U.S. history that many in the community are making sure is not forgotten 4 decades later.
Latinos were being sent to the front lines deliberately, were lower achievers in the eyes of the government, but when it came to war and the need for cannon fodder, were prime meat.
This is Rosalio Munoz. He was an outspoken student leader back then and co-founder of the Chicano Moratorium, an organized effort to mobilize Mexican Americans and Chicanos to oppose the Vietnam War.
The disproportionate death rate of Chicanos in Vietnam, which was the primary motivation, was part of a whole web of oppression, higher dropout rates, more people going to prisons.
So on August 29th, 1970, they decided to march. It became the largest anti-war action by any ethnic group in the United States.
It was a wonderful thing. And it subliminally got covered over by the brutal violence that followed an hour or 2 hours earlier. I remember Ruben Salazar came up to me in the middle of the march and giving me a huge abrazo and saying, congratulations, you did it.
Salazar was a columnist for the LA Times, reporting on issues that mattered to the Chicano community. He was also a leading voice in the community's anti-war movement. He went to the moratorium march that day. And when the protests turned violent, Salazar ducked into a local bar. A police officer had fired a tear gas canister at the bar's entrance. The police claimed the canister struck Salazar in the head and killed him instantly. But a lot of people questioned the circumstances that ended his life.
All righty, so there you have it, and I'd like to welcome, we've got 2 guests waiting to speak with us. I'd like to welcome Lupe Carrasco Cardona, co-chair of the 50th Anniversary Chicano Moratorium Commemorative Organizing Committee. Lupe is also a Los Angeles Unified School District teacher, a member of United Teachers of Los Angeles, and serves on the California Ethnic Studies Commission. Lupe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us. We're really excited to be on the show this morning. Thank you.
Okay, I'd also like to welcome Jorge Rodriguez, also a co-chair of the 50th Anniversary Chicano Moratorium Commemorative Los Angeles Committee. He is a longtime civil labor and immigrants' rights activist based in Los Angeles. Jorge and Lupe have both been helping organize the 50th Chicano Moratorium Anniversary for the last 2.5 years. And of course, Jorge, a lot of people recognize the Rodriguez family, who have been for so many years very, very active leading activists in East Los Angeles in particular. Jorge, welcome.
Thank you very much, Margaret, for having us on your show. We really appreciate it.
Jorge, let's start with you, because to give us some context here, because when this event took place, there was a lot happening across the country and even in other parts of the world in terms of social movements campaigning for people of color. There was the Young Lords in Chicago and in New York, the Brown Berets, of course, also the American Indian Movement protests. protesting defense of indigenous sovereignty, of course, the Black Panther Party and others, and the burgeoning student movement in Mexico protesting right-wing state repression, and of course, all of the struggles happening against racism against Chicanos in schools in East LA. So Jorge, make those connections for us, because all of this was part of the context of this tremendous event of 30,000 people coming out, Jorge.
You know, we during that time, we had the uprisings, as you well put it, during the 1970s. We had the killing of the Kent State students in May by the National Guard, who were also protesting against the war. The students, the Black students at Jackson State, who were also killed protesting the Vietnam War. You know, we had an entire nation making a call to end the war in Indochina, this unjust war that was basically fought for tungsten, iron, silver, gold. You know, there was no need to be there at all. As all wars that the U.S. has been involved in, we had a high unemployment rate among Blacks, 20%, 15% among Mexicans. We had inadequate housing, poor health. We had high school rates among Mexican Chicano students at 52%. It is still that today in America. 50 years later, we have not progressed. We still have poor health, underemployment, lack of jobs, but yet those low-paying jobs in trucking and the service industry, hospitality industry, and workers or truckers hauling materials from the ports are now considered essential jobs in America, and yet we weren't there back 50 years ago. And we have an administration today that is, you know, a racist, sexist, homophobic, fascist regime that continues to not only move to suppress the vote, but also has excluded people. And we see that this pandemic has heightened the contradictions of what America has been and all along, especially people of color, Native Americans. You know, we see the mass killing, you know, the large killings of Black young men taking place in this country right now, along with, and it's not as publicized, but there's many young Mexican Chicano young men that have also been killed by the police. But I think the important thing is that today in this movement with the Chicano moratorium, we stand in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. We stand in solidarity with our Native American brothers and sisters who are really suffering totally at the, you know, this pandemic has really affected them and other people of color, and unfortunately also some poor whites across the country who also suffer with high unemployment, lack of health, high death. We look at right now, today, yesterday, they did a study about the 80% of the infants born in LA County are COVID infected, and 12 of them have already died. And a mother died, she was pregnant. And, you know, that shouldn't be happening today in America. It's like the infant mortality rate that was taking place in the 60s, especially among Blacks in the South, the high infant mortality rate that took place then. So I think we can see what America is like today, the land of freedom and justice.
Right. Well, thank you for putting that so well in context for us, Jorge. Now, Lupe, for our listeners in Southern California, what can they expect for this 50th anniversary Chicano moratorium event? Just tell us about that and also where people could get information and get involved. Lupe.
Sure.
Carazo Cardona.
Sure, thank you. Yes, they can get information from the website, which is chicano-moratorium.com, but they can also find information at facebook.com/50thChicanoMoratorium. And what they can expect is it's really something that we had to adjust according to, you know, the pandemic that we're in. And Koki just did a really good job of explaining how COVID is impacting communities of color. So we wanted to make sure to protect our community. So we've made a lot of adjustments from the original plan that we've been working on for 2 years. And so essentially we have two options. We have a caravan option and a march option. And even though there are two different, one set of folks are going to be marching and another are going to be in a caravan, they're both going to come together, at Atlantic and Whittier Boulevard. So the folks that will, the folks that will be choosing the caravan option are going to be meeting at Gregg Road and Whittier Boulevard in Cico Rivera and at 9 o'clock in the morning. At 11
Could you repeat that? Could you repeat that one?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Gregg Road and Whittier Boulevard is where the caravan cars will meet at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning. At 11 a.m., they're going to proceed to drive really slowly down or going westbound on Whittier Boulevard. The folks who are choosing to do the march option, we're going to make sure to have masks, hand sanitizer provided to all those that don't have it. They will be meeting at Atlantic Park on 6th Street and Atlantic Boulevard in East Los Angeles. There will be a pre-rally there at Atlantic Park for the marchers. There will be a pre-rally that will also be broadcast on facebook.com/50thChicanoMoratorium at the caravan site. And at about approximately 11:45, we're going to be in communication, the march with the caravan. That is about the time we're thinking the two will converge at Atlantic Boulevard and Whittier Boulevard, and we'll continue going westbound on Whittier Boulevard to Ruben Salazar Park. At Ruben Salazar Park, the marchers are going to go into the park, and there will be a post-rally there as well. There will not be any booths or, an extensive program because we're trying to ensure the safety of the community while at the same time commemorating the 50th anniversary of what was supposed to have been a peaceful anti-war demonstration in East Los Angeles, but ended up violent at the hands of the police and the sheriff's department that came in and as you said earlier, killed four people, attacked 60, and just really completely changed the event of August 29th, 1970, from something of families coming together to something of infamy. And we are here to commemorate that 50 years later.
Right. Well, if we get that detailed information, we would be happy to post it on our social media and get that information out on this important 50th anniversary of the Chicano Moratorium. By the way, it was the largest anti-war demonstration of any ethnic group in the United States, and I think it still has that distinction. Jorge, I've got less than a minute before we have to wrap up. Just give us a quick final thought here.
The people of color in this country are suffering the worst ever in our so-called democracy. And I think what we need to do is be in that car caravan, be on the streets, raising our voice against the injustices that we as citizens of this country are suffering, and we need to reach out and tell our brothers and sisters across the country to register and vote. We need to end the tyranny that we are suffering under these days in America together.
Yeah. Well, you have me in tears, Jorge. You're absolutely true. Our communities are under attack. We're being killed. You never know when you come out of your house if you're going to survive or not. So we appreciate you all for all of your work, all of your planning, and all of the logistics that you have so carefully worked out. Thank you so much, Lupe and Jorge. All the best to you.
Thank you for having me.
All righty. I'd like to, we are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott, our audio engineer, Kiana Williams, assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and y'all, please stay safe. Thank you.
Está sintonizando KBOO Portland, tu radio comunitaria, a través del 90.7 FM KBOO Portland y en línea a través de KBOO.FM.
You're listening to Community Radio
KBOO Portland.